Hello and welcome to the Scottish Housing News Podcast with me, Kieran Finlay, and my co-host, Jimmy Black. Rural housing is in the news because there isn't enough, and care is in the news because people are stuck in hospital when they should be recovering back in their own homes. We like to be holistic, so we looked for guests who could cover both bases.
Kirsty Morrison is Chief Executive of Alban Housing Society, a builder of Fit Homes, which are bristling with technology to help people live independently. And Ronnie McRae is CEO at the Communities Housing Trust, which helps local communities develop housing which meets their specific needs, for example, homes in Colonsay designed to suit older people. So let's start with Kirsty. You recently wrote a blog for the Scottish Housing News. Kirsty, can you pick out the main issues which you were trying to highlight in that blog?
Yes, certainly. So Alban has a history of working in innovation, both in design of homes, but also in technology. We have a project called Fit Homes that is the build of 32 homes through the Inverness and Highlands City Region deal and the development of sensor technology. The sensor technology is ambience in people's homes who are vulnerable and allows them to live independently at home for as long as they can. For me, for Alban, it's a core part of our business. There's a real crisis in the care at home and care home sector in the Highlands. And ultimately, at the end of the day, we're always the last resort. The landlord's the last resort. So having us explore this technology, utilise it in multiple different vulnerable groups, homes, allows them to feel supported, for families and carers to feel supported, and to be able to stay in their home where there isn't somewhere to go. So for me, that's the key point, is there's a gap within the care sector, and Alban as an organisation are wanting to look after our tenants. Tenancy sustainment's key, and to prevent the need for people to have to enter care or care at home facilities.
So Kirsty, what is a fit home? What qualifies a home to be a fit home?
So there's two elements. The one is the build. So we've 16 homes in Dalmore and Alness. They were built before the City Region deal, and they're built to a specification where you can move walls. So they're adaptable. They're wheelchair accessible, obviously, all in one level. They've got the same floor covering. The oven and kitchen space is of a certain height that you could access at different times, and that's movable. Then through the City Region deal, we've developed more homes at Stratton Farm in Inverness and also at Castle Park in Dingwall. And again, they're all built to different designs, that means they're more adaptable. That isn't where, for me, the fit homes ends. This is just a build. For me, the actual value for money is in the technology. So what the technology is that sensors, ambient sensors, so that means that they're unobtrusive. There's no cameras, there's no anything that would upset someone that was in their home. And we have them placed in specific areas in people's homes, such as their fridge, their toilets, the cupboard in the kitchen where you would most likely open to get a cup of coffee, so on your kettle, your bed, etc. So there's multiple sensors that all trigger back to a hub. That hub then translates to either a family member or a carer or a key professional, and it tells them about your daily behaviour patterns. So if you're frail and elderly, we can track if you're at risk of falls. So there's lots of work we're doing with academic researchers around what predictive behaviours can we identify from people that have these sensors in their home. We've just developed a new interface based on our residents and their families' feedback, which talks about when the last time the patio door was opened, the front door, the ambient temperature in the home, the windows. And I always use the fact that my grandmother had dementia, and the peace of mind I would have had having an app on my phone to tell me that she hadn't been out the front door, she'd made a cup of coffee. All of that combined with, I would have known that her patterns of behaviour changed when she stopped going to the fridge and making cups of coffee because she liked her food. So we would have identified earlier that she was obviously experiencing dementia. But working in Edinburgh at the time, we had a rota at home to check where she was, if she was in the house, had she taken her medication. So I think the peace of mind that would have given me with direct lived experience of that is just, it would have changed our lives as a family. And we could have potentially kept her at home for longer as well. So the technology for me is where we get bigger bang for our buck in terms of allowing people to stay at home independently and as long as they can.
Could you give a shout out to the partners involved in this, both in building and constructing this kind of property and those who are involved in the surveillance?
Yeah, sure. So we have the Inverness and Highland City Region deal provided the capital funding for the second set of 32 fit homes. That's Scottish Government as well. And the key partner in the Inverness and Highland City Region deal is the Highland Council. So we work very closely with them. The development of the sensor is we worked with Robert Gordon University and had a PhD student who's now got his doctorate, and he developed an individual sensor for Alban that allows us to basically economies of scale and providing our own sensor. We also work with a number of other partners in academia, Glasgow University, Edinburgh University, Stirling, etc. But the interesting thing is the allocation of a fit home doesn't follow the normal allocation process. So it's referrals from GPs. So we've got great relationship with local GPs. The NHS are obviously involved, social work at the council are involved. So there's around eight partners that sit around a table to ensure that a fit home is appropriate for that individual, that there is a support or care worker, because it's not Alban's role. We are the kind of middleman that provides the sensors. We don't look at people's data either. So there's a huge amount of partners around the table in terms of the start of this, which was around 2017, and to where we are now. And there's obviously lots of future opportunities. We also are working with Housing Association in Glasgow around a pilot there, and obviously some other organisations in terms of testing, having a test bed that's wider than just the Highlands.
How does it work? A number of organisations have been using analogue technology for similar purposes for a long time, and obviously things like the community alarm services that local authorities provide. But that technology is outdated now, and you know, analogue's going to digital. So I'm guessing that you've gone for a fully digital platform.
Yes.
Is this stuff that could be put into any house, not just a brand new house? And the other question I have is, in the Highlands, particularly in scattered areas, how are you actually gathering the data? Is it the mobile network or is it something else?
Yep. So we have retrofitted technology to eight other homes. So they're not purpose-built City Region deal homes. And again, that was to test that these sensors could be utilised in almost any home. Some of it's dependent on the build structure, dependent on thickness of walls, etc. But in 90% of cases, it can be retrofitted into any home that we have. The platform that we use we use Wi-Fi signals to communicate the sensor activity. So part of the package that when you get a fit home is that you're provided with internet access. So that means that all of the information can be translated back through Wi-Fi. Our new sensor goes beyond that and actually uses what's called channel state information. And that's Wi-Fi that can assess and sense you moving around your home. So you get much more minute by second detail rather than the platform we use at the moment. This is all in development, and obviously we'll be working on testing and building a bigger test bed, etc. But again, the level of detail and information we can get from a channel state information signal is much more detailed than what we've got at the moment. So, and it may be able to detect breathing patterns, changes in gait, which are often an indicator of dementia as well. So we're working with universities on that as well, because they obviously want to access and understand the possibilities of this, because there's possibilities wider than just keeping someone at home for longer. I forgot your second question.
Well, we were talking about the mobile network, I think, weren't we? And just exactly how you get signals across, yep, you know, vast areas in the Highlands.
Mm-hmm. And at the moment, it's most of our properties are in areas where there is good broadband signal. So we haven't had to use 3G, 4G, 5G. In some cases, you don't get 4 and 5G in the Highlands. And we haven't put retrofit sensors into homes that don't have internet access. So that's something we'd need to look at in terms of digital inclusion going forward, because there are properties that we have that just don't have any access to Wi-Fi. For me, the key thing around this is it's unobtrusive. So, Kieran, you'd use surveillance. We would never say surveillance because we'd be saying...
I did wonder if that was the correct term when I said it, yeah.
For me, surveillance is around cameras. And our customers were absolutely clear they didn't want cameras in their homes, mm-hmm, which I fully understand and accept, even if I would have wanted that for my grandmother. But you can understand people still want their privacy no matter what stage of life they're at. We also have, it's not just elderly and frail, we house people with life-limiting diseases, younger So there's lots of different customer groups for me that this is all a benefit to the public purse. But as this is a test bed at the moment, where we've installed the sensors, we've been able to install broadband, and it's been relatively simple.
I promise, Ronnie, we'll come to you in a second. I just find this really interesting. Kirsty, what are the data implications here? There's a continuing information provided by the technology every day and accessed by a range of organisations. Who owns the data and how are the tenants protected?
Yeah, so the tenants own the data. Alban don't own any data and we don't access it either. So the information, the data that's carried in the sensors over to the interface is only accessible by the person that's been nominated by that resident. So it could be a mother, father, brother, it could be a social worker or a key worker from a support organisation, but the tenants own the data. Alban doesn't have access to any of that, so we wouldn't be able to analyse it without their permission. So that was quite a large part of the discussion in the beginning about who owns the data, and we've got information sharing protocols and data protection all around all of that data as well, so it's kept safe and secure and the tenants know that it's their data. Alban don't own it.
I suppose equally it could be used for other beneficial reasons. Is that happening?
That's if the tenant agrees. It can be used for research and academic purposes. Again, we've got agreements with the academia that allow them to look at the data anonymised. It wouldn't give them any detail of an individual or be able to be identifiable. But for they can use it for different health implications as well. So actually, can this data start showing different behaviour pattern changes that identifies different illnesses? Again, all about prevention as well, but absolutely the data belongs to the tenant and they were very clear that that was important to them.
Kirsty, last week question from you on this. The tenants themselves, do they sometimes cause difficulties when, for example, some tenants might switch everything off at night in their house? I mean, that's quite a thing that older people like me quite often do, is just turn everything off. Or is there anyone who just can't work the gadgets, can't use the equipment? Or are there people who just say, no, this is too private. I don't want anyone to hear me when I go to the bathroom, for example, and they try and turn the system off. Do you have this kind of difficulty?
We don't. We also, before, as I said, the allocations process is very detailed, so it takes a lot of time explaining to customers. Because the sensors don't hear or see anything, all it does is notice when you're moving about, how many times you've flushed the toilets, how many times you've opened the fridge, but it doesn't rely on the resident doing anything. The sensors are there. In most cases, they forget they're there because they're unobtrusive. And every time it transfers back to us, we're obviously getting that, well, as the tenants, carers getting that data, they would be able to tell if something was wrong because the interface would then show that there was no signal coming in or the person hadn't moved in, I don't know, 20 hours, for example. But we don't have any issues with residents because in the main, they've had a huge part of the allocation process. And in the main, they forget that they're there because they are ambient. Again, this was what the residents said when did some focus groups. We want sensors that are unobtrusive, that we don't know that's there, and can capture information without us having to do anything. I compare that to community alarms. So again, my grandmother had a community alarm that she used to hang on her mirror because I think she thought it was a necklace. And she didn't understand what it was for, so she would hang it up. But also that generational thing where she wouldn't have pressed for help anyway. She could have fallen and she wouldn't have pressed for help because a lot of pride. But obviously that having this sensor would detect that things are happening in the home, and then the carer, family member, professional key worker would look at it and identify there's an issue. So we've not had any people switching things off or not wanting them, because that's clear as part of the discussion. This is the package that comes with fit homes or the retrofitted home as well.
Thanks, Kirsty. Ronnie, welcome to the podcast. Could you summarise what the Communities Housing Trust is and what it does?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, we're a community support organisation. We're a not-for-profit charity. We work alongside a sister organisation in south of Scotland, Community Housing. And between us, we cover the whole of Scotland. We work from Edinburgh, Glasgow, north, and they cover the south. It's really about just assisting communities get predominantly the housing, affordable housing that they need to remain sustainable, but also the wider package that's included alongside housing developments. So it's it can be schools, for example. Communities now own schools and health centres and tourist information centres, sports facilities. All these things that are required to make a community, you know, make it an attractive place to live and work. So it is quite a diverse role that we have. A lot of it is about research and development and innovation, you know, working with the housing associations, local authorities and Scottish Government to provide more choice in affordable housing tenures, because especially small communities, we find really need a wide range of choice in affordable housing tenures. So that's the broad brush of what we do, but we help communities with business plans, housing strategies, and building the right partnerships, because any of the projects need a wide range of partners to make them viable.
You've recently been involved with the trust in Ascent, and I think you've got £114,000, I think, for a feasibility study for housing on the Glebe. But it's not just about housing there, is it? Can you tell us a wee bit more about that project?
Yeah, well, that's again, that's been based on proof of concept that's happened elsewhere. Like I said, it's not just about housing and a wide range of housing tenures. It's about making sure that the infrastructure's there, whether it's social or economic. So on that development, there's going to be a focus on providing ancillary facilities, likes of commercial buildings, things like walking paths, cycle paths, potentially woodland crofts, tourist facilities, and educational facilities based on land use and things like that. So quite a wide range of uses for what is now an extremely strategic site. And in an area that has been constrained for a long, long time through lack of sites.
And then in Colonsay, you've got a project in Colonsay that's live, I think, at the moment. That seemed to involve a crowdfunder. It involved funding from a whole range of sources. Somehow you must have extracted some land from somebody on Colonsay, because I think that can be one of the hardest parts. Again, can you fill us in on what you've been doing there?
Yeah, again, it's about partnerships, and there's a wide range of partnerships there. We're supporting Colonsay Community Development Company to do this project. The partners in that are Argyll and Bute Council, the Scottish Government, Highlands and Islands Enterprise, Maui, importantly, are a local company, fish farm company on the island, and everyone's pulling together their West Highland Housing Association, a wide range of partners all contributing, and it's about providing choice in affordable housing tenure, but also how do you support the local economy. The local business was struggling for workers. Part of the allocations we're looking at there is how do you attract new families to the area. The school role is falling. Some of the service providers are struggling, the pier and the airport, Coast Guards, fire service, all these services are struggling. So it's about how do you use housing and development as an opportunity to regenerate and repopulate, as well as obviously really importantly deal with the local housing needs that are there at the moment. So this is only phase one that's been worked on at the moment. And it's providing a range of housing, but there's quite a chunk of land for a phase two, which we would hope comes fairly quickly after phase one. And we've also, like I said, working with West Highland Housing Association, they're looking at a development elsewhere on the island. So the whole strategic plan is going to be quite transformative to the island.
Kirsty, you said in your blog that the social care system in the Highlands could collapse. You also said that half the young people are planning to leave, and obviously there's the housing shortage. So there's some issues. There are some practical things which the Scottish Government is talking about doing, and so let's talk about them a little bit and see if they would have any beneficial effect in rural areas. Doubling the council tax on second homes and long-term empty homes, would that be helpful? Mm-hmm. They're talking about that today.
Yeah. For us, there's obviously clear issues with the number of second homes that there are in the Highlands, but also the fact that that then prices out a lot of people out of the market. So there's no access to homes. And obviously, even in some of the smaller villages, when there are second homes and they're coming onto the market, they're being bought at extortionate prices. So it's actually a load of young people don't have access to any housing. Like the rest of Scotland, there's obviously always a need for more social housing in every community. But as Ronnie had mentioned earlier, there's a lot around the a range of affordable tenures. So we have a mid-market subsidiary as well, where we have 216 mid-market rent properties. We're looking at the growth of that, as well as our social housing and obviously our fit homes as well. So we need to look at being able to allow young people to stay in the area. There's also the part of the social care issues are people can't get affordable housing. So there are council reports that say there's an issue with recruitment and retention, again, because people can't access affordable housing. We also, as an organisation for Alban, one of our challenges is our rurality and the size of our population. So we've got almost 3,800 homes over 70 communities. So we've got a base in Inverness and Invergordon. The travel time to go out to see a tenant that needs support, for example, can be hours and hours. You can do one in a day. The same exists for the social care sector. So if you're a social care worker that needs to go out and provide care at home once a day to someone living in Tongue, for example, or we have a lovely village called Talmine, that can be most of your day gone. So there's no economies of scale for social care workers to have to commit a whole day to supporting one person. Again, this is where we see fit homes comes in. So rather than having to travel out to that person, you could look at your app and interface and say, well, they're fine, they've been up, made a cup of tea, doors closed, ambient temperature in the house is okay, so I'm satisfied, everything's okay. So this is about cutting down on the issues around having such a wide geography that Alban has. I've mainly worked in urban housing associations and local authority, so this is a very different environment for me and challenges that I didn't imagine. And so it's an absolute learning experience, but it is a huge issue for us in terms of that size. What, and again, in terms of new developments, we've just recently started on site, but we're working on site in Lyrk. So that's a multi-tenure site that has fit homes in it, social rent, and also another lift home as well. But we're working very closely with the local community there because they own the land. But there's huge issues around the cost, because you've got the location, so it's very rural. You've got access, which is difficult as well. And we've got canal supply chain issues and lack of contractors in the Highlands as well. So all of that's a kind of perfect storm for continuing to develop affordable homes when it's really, really expensive to develop one single affordable home, as well as there's no homes to buy. Private rented sector is strong, but again, that's not an option for a lot of people because of the cost. So there's a lot that needs to be done to kind of ease the burden, I think, on housing associations, the council, our partners like Communities Housing Trust, in terms of how do we have an economic affordable housing development programme across the Highlands.
Okay, Ronnie, could I ask you, one of the things that you do is you help people create low-cost affordable housing for sale, but how do you prevent those houses that you help to create disappearing off into the second home market at some point in the future?
Well, the mechanism that we generally use is the rural housing burden. That's a Scottish Government title condition, so it's applied to the title. It's not like the new supply shared equity Scottish Government scheme that is awarded to an applicant and a householder. It's applied to the title of the house rather than given to the householder. So that's not lifted from the title, regardless of who owns the house. Unfortunately, you know, there's been some instances where new supply shared equity has been lost to the market, and that can't really happen in smaller communities, so we need to protect against that. So the rural housing burden's doing a good job on that front. It's well recognised by Scottish Government, and landowners trust it, which makes access to land easier. Communities trust it as well. So because what they don't want to see is any housing getting lost. And it's enabled a lot of innovative stuff to happen. We just finished a project recently in Rothie Marcus, purely because of the rural housing burden. On working with a cooperative landowner, we were able to provide 66% affordable housing, low cost home ownership housing through self-build for no public subsidy at all. Now that wouldn't have been possible without the rural housing burden.
So does this just tie the home to people who have a connection to the local area? Are there any differences with the limitations and extent to what the local area means if this house is on an island or it's on the mainland and so on?
No, I mean, you know, like Kirsty was saying earlier, same as fit homes, the allocations policy is key, and for community-led housing, that's the advantage in the partnership working with the likes of a housing association, likes of Instaffin, for example, a recent project there with Loch Allen Sky Housing Association. They had their mainstream social rent housing. They built to the community through the Rural and Island Housing Fund. They built two, which again are social rent equivalent, the same rent level, but they have a different allocations policy, still complies with the Housing Scotland Act, but it's more flexible and locally targeted. So each community tends to have its own needs, if you like, and they identify their main target groups, whether it's young families to keep the school open, or like Kirsty said, workers is a key one to keep economic, care workers, health workers. There's more flexibility for the community. Scottish Government have been great in working with these allocations policies. Again, it's the same housing tenure, if you like, but it's a different allocations policy. Housing Association is obviously an RSL. The community's houses are effectively classed as private rented. They're private tenancies. And also on staffing, we provided two low-cost home ownership. So again, a range of choice. There were only six houses, but there was a range of choice, and the allocations policies were key. And we find that in every community, because you need to target different groups to make sure that the community can be, well, more often than not now, what communities are talking about is regeneration and repopulation. And like Kirsty says, a lot of youngsters are moving away, not because they want to, but because they don't have too much in the way of choice. But what we're finding is a lot of those youngsters who went away got really good skills and experience elsewhere, and they would love to take them back to their own communities if the community can create a package. Like I say, the range of choice and affordable housing, the social infrastructure and the economic infrastructure, rural communities are hugely desirable, where we can break down the silos and everyone can work together.
One thing that's always puzzled me is that particularly houses in rural areas, housing associations and other developers in rural areas haven't made so much use of modern methods of construction as you might expect. There was certainly a scheme on Mull recently where the wee house company, or Connect Modular, I think they also call themselves, provided those houses. They come in the back of a lorry and you screw them together. Why is it that method of construction hasn't been more widely adopted, and do you do that?
There's a range of reasons. You know, modern methods of construction absolutely has its place, but when we're looking at regenerating and repopulating areas, I think Kirsty might agree with me that building the houses is one thing. So if you can just plunk a house there, that's fine. That'll meet a need, but we have a real shortage in labour. And materials, our costs are high. We haven't found modern methods of construction to be significantly cheaper on any projects. So cost-wise, it's difficult. But from a rural perspective, what we really need to be working at is how do we use this package that I talked about earlier, of housing, social and economic benefits to attract new businesses to the areas, because similar to Kirsty's employees who have to go over, maybe spend a whole day to do one visit, if you've got contractors going over to do one piece of maintenance in affordable homes, the business plan for affordable homes is shot to pieces. So having workers out, you know, companies in the rural areas who can build and maintain and repair, plus be living and working in the communities, creating a circular economy, is a massive benefit. So I don't think there's any silver bullets with regards to construction techniques. I don't think modern methods of construction on its own is going to do anything. And I don't think having smaller companies out in the rural areas can deal with it all either. I think it needs to be, as with housing tenures, I think you need a range of choice in how you construct and build. There's got to be, obviously, housing build standards are increasing, which is good, but if we can't deliver them, then the standards can be as high as you want. It's going to do you no good if you've got no houses to build. So for us, it's more complex than just saying here's modern methods of construction. It's the only answer. Our opinion is it's not the only answer. It's part of the answer.
Kirsty.
Yep, I fully agree with everything Ronnie said. We've thought about modular builds, but exactly like Ronnie said, we're struggling for contractors. The pool of house builders in the Highlands is very small. And often those house builders are also building corporate property developments, schools, etc., working on regeneration projects for buildings at the same time. So there's a really slim market for house building. Supply and demand, we know what's happened with trying to get timber in one case for us, where our developments are delayed. So I think there's a range of options we need to look at to support new and affordable housing development. Modular may have its place, but for us, we'd just like to get a really good pool of contractors out there, as Ronnie said, in the rural areas as well, rather than just being in, for example, Inverness, where I'm just now. So, I think there's a lot of different options we need to look at, because it's becoming more difficult to develop new homes. It's not becoming any easier at all. Whilst there's a crisis in the market that young people, anyone needs a social home, it's much harder for us to develop than it used to be. Again, that's all around the number of issues we see around specifically the Highlands.
Kirsty, we have a new housing minister. There's a housing bill in the pipeline. What will Alban be doing to push the issue of rural housing?
Yeah, so we've when the rent cap was introduced, so the suggestion last year under the Tenant Protection Bill and Cost of Living Act, that we lobbied and wrote to a number of ministers, we met with ministers, we provided evidence papers around the impact of capping or keeping a low or 0% rent increase would have significant impact for our planned maintenance programme. That's your low-hanging fruit for anyone. So at the same time, we'll continue to do this with the new housing minister, hoping to invite him to one of our developments to understand everything Ronnie and I have just talked about in terms of there's different challenges here than there is when I worked in Glasgow, when I worked in Dundee, very different challenges. And it would be good for him to come and see that as well. So we'll continue to bring politicians to our new developments to meet our customers. I think that's really key for politicians to understand the tenant voice. And we did a lot of that with the rent cap as well. What is our tenants actually wanting? So we fed that back as well. So yeah, hoping to meet him soon and bring him along to see, particularly Fit Homes, because it's different. It's a bit of our USP, but it also exemplifies the issues in the Highlands with employment, with affordable housing, with supports, with all the issues that we've covered today. So hoping that the private sector, the new housing bill that's coming out, we'll also look at mid-market rent. You'll be aware that mid-market rent's captured under a private residential tenancy. So it's capped at 3% of a rent increase, which doesn't feel very fair when our own tenants, Alban, have a 5% rent increase this year. Again, going out to consultation with our tenants. So it feels like mid-market rent's in the wrong tenure type. So hoping that there's, whether they can make a tenure type for mid-market rent specifically, it'd be good to let the Housing Minister understand the differences, that how different mid-market rent is from private renting. And they're all kind of cobbled together at the moment, which causes difficulty as well.
Ronnie, what's your thoughts on this one? What's on your agenda for the new housing minister?
Yeah, well, I mean, policy legislation and funding that have come from Scottish Government in the recent years have been great, really, really helpful. But we've also had Brexit and COVID, which has knocked us back a step or two. So, yeah, I think given the opportunities we have, I think we need to start working better together. And this is an opportunity with different ministers now to make sure the system's working as well as it can, because there's inconsistencies across the systems at the moment that in my opinion, are opportunities to be sorted out and moved on. From our perspective, because we're communities and not just housing, it's important we don't just look at the housing minister. We speak to various ministers, the economy, the rural economy, all the environment, all these different ones. It's important that we reduce the silo effect, if you like, because especially rural housing development, or more appropriately, community development, impacts on so many different portfolios. And I think we need to push for a discussion on that, the benefits of housing to so many different portfolios. But, you know, the infrastructure's there, the legislation policy is there. We just need to get better through stronger partners working about delivering it, because at the end of the day, you can have all the policy you want. If you're not delivering anything, it's pointless. There's no, the legislation and policy is useless. Really have to focus more on delivery.
Okay, we're coming to the end now, but I'd like to get an answer from both you guys. Just give a sense of what it means for local people to be able to stay and build communities in the places where they grew up.
We have, I think I mentioned Talmine earlier on, where we have, it's a beautiful village on a beach, absolutely said, worked in urban housing, was like, this is social housing, this is phenomenal. We actually built those properties a number of years ago to allow them to be able to be extended. So the roof you can extend, and that was to accommodate growing families. So there's only a number, I think we've got about 27 homes there, but we understood that families wanting to stay there, there's individuals who live in those homes whose industry is reliant upon living in that area. And if some of these families left, that would impact, just as we mentioned earlier, on school rolls. It would impact on the local post office. It would impact on the school bus being able to come to the village. So the foresight that Alban had many years ago when they built these to allow them to be extended allows growing families to stay in the area, which is so important when, as such a small local community that, as I said, relies on the economy there, relies on these people still staying here and having the ability to do that. It's not the same as when, if, for example, if you have a overcrowded home in Glasgow and you can move somebody to the next street or another estate or whatever, you don't have that opportunity when you live in a small village in Talmine or in any of our other very rural areas. And people want to stay. They've got family and history connections, as I said, economy. They don't want to take their kids out of school. So the picture's very different about how you allow people to stay in the place that they call home. And I think that's really important to us as an organisation as well.
Ronnie?
Yeah, I mean, similarly, I think, you know, there's an awful lot of great examples of community-led developments from Gerlocht, Staffin, Strontian, and it's not just looking at affordable housing, it's looking at schools and health centres. And it's not just protecting these infrastructures, it's about improving them. Communities are doing a lot and they're coming up with great ideas for developing new housing tenures and models. A lot more local authorities are really coming on board with this. Perthshire Council, Moray Council, Aberdeenshire, all these local authorities are really wanting to take their lead from the rural communities and create partnerships. Perthshire, for example, there's an awful lot of different communities in Perthshire working with housing associations, the council, and there's a lot of really good potential there. It's difficult times, but I think working together we'll find solutions for them and be building a lot more housing quite quickly.
Excellent. Thanks both for joining us on this podcast featuring rural housing. Thanks to Kirsty Morrison from Alban Housing Society and Ronnie McRae from the Communities Housing Trust. My thanks to Jimmy Black. We'll be back in a couple of weeks.